This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast. There must be a God somewhere. There must be a God. There must be a God somewhere.
Church tradition growing up with people mostly of my own complexion, we would have been done now. I mean, it would be over. We sang it like 4 times. This can become vain repetition. We know the words, we know the tune. We even sang the last tag like 3 or 4 times. Okay, and he must be done. But at St. James's AME Zion Church, it was not done. Because this was a people who had learned how to persevere. They had actually learned how to wait. They had learned how to hope. And if you really are going to wait and hope, you have to be able to sing more than just 3 times. So we're going to sing it once or twice more. As an offering of hope to the God who is somewhere and is here. Over my head, I hear music in the air. Choir may be seated. Where does that song come from? In the strict sense, we don't know. It comes to us out of the oral tradition, not originally written down, not originally attributed to an author, a particular composer. But we know, generally speaking, where this song comes from. It comes out of the experience of a people. And almost certainly, the first time it was sung outside, out in the fields, where this people worked for another's benefit, labored for another's profit, torn from their own home, were now strangers in a very strange land. And in the midst of those conditions, of the most extraordinary oppression. Someone in the field began to sing this. Over my head, I hear music in the air. And in the form that this song comes to us, the A-A-A-B form, the meaning of that mysterious phrase is deferred until the end. Right? You don't really, that's a very mysterious beginning. What does this mean, this statement that over my head, somewhere above me, because around me, here on the ground, there may not be a lot of music. It's not a very harmonious situation I find myself in after this incredible dislocation of myself, my family, my people. But this voice, these voices begin to sing, over my head I hear music in the air, and it's repeated three times. Where is this going? What's the meaning of this? In my church tradition, I think the most common song form, I don't know, it would be interesting to compare notes with some of your music faculty here, is the AABA form. It's a very different form. Let me illustrate it. AABA starts with a statement of a kind of a home theme, like this is an AABA melody. So it's stated once, that's like the home. So that was the home theme, and then we do it again. And I'm very happily at home in this beautiful harmonious major key. And then I go out away from that major key into a bit of minor excursion. It's like going for a little walk. But then I come home to my nice cottage, and I think it's time to have some tea. Okay. So that song form is well suited to people who are at home, but have this experience of going away from home, like I did yesterday. I was at home in Philadelphia on the other end of the country. Came away to the Pacific Northwest, to Spokane, where I've never been before. Walked in, felt a little out of place, but I know that I'll go back home. Not a song form very well suited when you've taken a one-way forced journey across an ocean. And instead, you wonder, what is the meaning of this experience? And you realize, if there is a God, if there is a meaning to be found in this experience, it will only be found in some eschatological revelation. And so the AAAB form is the eschatological form of music, in which life as we know it now is a mystery. Full of hints of possibility, I hear music in the air, but not resolved. In fact, creating an increasing sense of tension until the disclosure of meaning in the final verse, in the final verse or line of the song. And even in that final line, as you discovered in the form that we sang it, and as I first learned it, there's this long further delay even in the disclosure. There must, what's going to come? And it's not till we get to the penultimate word, be a God somewhere. This is a confession of faith in the face of all kinds of reasons not to believe. I did this with a group a few years ago, and a friend of mine came up afterwards. He might have been one of those conservative, rich, white people that was referred to earlier. And he said, Andy, I don't like that song. I said, well, really, I think it's great. What don't you like? He said, it's a liberal song. A liberal song. I said, what? What are you talking about? He said, you know, it's so vague. There must be a God somewhere. I said, oh, you've missed the whole point. This is the most radical possible declaration of faith in the context in which it was written. There's nothing fuzzy or vague or indeterminate or holding back about this confession of faith. This is a wholehearted belief in spite of everything I see around me, in spite of everything in the culture around me. I have this sense, we have this sense, that there is a cosmic harmony that discloses to us that we can put our whole weight in trust on a God who is there, and who is coming to redeem, reconcile, and restore. A number of years ago, I became more and more troubled by the sense that American Christians in the majority culture, my own culture, and American evangelical Christians, that kind of tribe of people which I've sort of been adopted into, not my own background, but sort of found myself in. I found myself more and more troubled by the sense that we had ended up in a very dysfunctional relationship with American culture. And the way you know you're in a dysfunctional relationship is that both sides in a dysfunctional relationship see the worst in one another and see one another at their worst. So you know that in a marriage or even in an intimate friendship, you can get into these pitched battles, these moments of dysfunction. I hear this happens, at least. I mean, friends of mine have told me about this, in which both parties end up seeing the worst in each other and drawing out the worst in each other. And I thought, you know, I feel like the surrounding culture portrays my fellow Christians at our worst, our most narrow, our most judgmental. These are not actually, the portrayals I see of us are not the church that I know and get have the privilege of living in, not primarily. It's a caricature. It's the worst in us. But then I thought, but when I'm in church and I hear people talk about culture, what they almost always talk about is the worst in culture. And so it's not just that the culture is portraying me and my fellow Christian believers at our worst. It's that when we get together and talk about the culture, we single out all the things that are worst about the culture. Now, in different churches, people single out different things. But there is this tendency, and it's not least among the people who preach, to find the worst in the culture, the most dysfunctional features of our culture, and highlight it. And I think this is partly because it is to one's rhetorical advantage, as someone trying to call people to the life of the gathered community of God, that we portray the alternatives in as stark terms as we can. Or to put it more bluntly, sometimes we're tempted to make the world out there look worse than it is, so we can make the church look better than it is. So we can call people to the church by saying, look how bad it is out in the world. This extends to the point that when you ask seminarians to analyze portrayals of people out in the culture, they almost always give negative spins to what they see. In their book, I think it's Church on Sunday, Work on Monday, the authors whose names escape me because I did not prepare this and it's just coming to my mind right now, but it's a really good illustration, so I'll tell you later their names. They tell one anecdote that is backed up with broader qualitative research of a group of seminarians who were shown a gas station, someone working at a gas station in Florida at a moment when a hurricane was coming. And so all these people are trying to get out of Florida, and a lot of people have to fill up their car with gas. And so this person was serving the folks coming to fill up their cars on their way to evacuate from the coast. And they asked these seminarians, what do you see in this picture? And all the narratives they got back were narratives of exploitation. Well, he's gouging the prices. Like, this is an opportunity to make a whole lot of money at the expense of people who really need gas and can't go anywhere else. He's being kept there against his will. This is an employee who's being exploited, forced to work, when actually the right thing to do would be shut down the gas station, get out of town. There were all these narratives of greed, of exploitation, and no one picked up on the cues which were in the video they saw, that this person, who happened to be a person of African descent, African American, was in fact the owner of the gas station, was sacrificially keeping the gas station open of his own accord in order to serve people as they left his neighborhood, was taking great pride in his opportunity to serve his community at this moment. But none of them saw that. The narrative they had of culture, of this little piece of culture, just a gas station owner working at a station, they managed to find a way to make that an illustration of everything that's wrong in our culture. We both do this. It's a dysfunctional relationship. We instinctively go to the critique. Now, this can take very stark forms. A few years ago, in a number of Christian magazines, not the one I edit, I would like to say, an advertisement appeared for a book. And it is quite an extraordinary work of commercial communication. And it really struck me, and I thought it was worth us pausing on for a moment. In this ad, I want to say this ad appeared, as ads often do, before the book appeared. So I had not read the book when I saw the ad. I still have not read the book. It may be a very helpful book. It is by a pastor who, in fact, I have many reasons to think has many gifts and many things to offer. But I'm not commenting on the book or even the author. I'm commenting on the commercial message itself. Because commercial messages succeed in communicating even if you don't know the book or the author. So here we have a pair of hands folded in as if in prayer. Actually, rather than me telling you what I see, why don't you turn to one neighbor and just say, what do you see in this ad? What do you notice? What strikes you? And what does it say about culture? And what does it say about we, the people of God, who are implicitly addressed? Turn to one neighbor and just exegete this ad for a minute. Had enough time? All right. Let's hear a few things you saw. Nice and loud so other people can hear. What'd you notice? What struck you? What's remarkable about this piece of communication, visual communication?
The rubber gloves protect us from the dirty culture.
Yes. So culture is something that is potentially toxic, quite dirty. So make sure you're well sheathed before engaging with it. Great.
The delusion that what's inside the glove must be
rubber. Ah-ha-ha. Yes. First cleanse the inside of your dishwashing gloves and then cleanse the outside. I believe that's the original Greek. But yes, there's this presumption all the contamination is outside, not inside the gloves. Fantastic. Yes.
Two things. Jesus went left to do those cultural things without the gloves. He touched lepers.
Wow.
And EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, could be an evangelical protection agency.
So we have this model of Jesus who touched areas of dis-ease that no one else would touch, and yet the people who follow this Lord Jesus now are asking, deliver us. A couple more things. Yes?
We're already contaminated, so we need detox.
Ah, so there is this sense, and now it's easy to critique this, but don't we also have this sense, indeed is this not what Walter was awakening in us, the sense that I myself am somehow contaminated by this. I have been infected by the toxins of my culture, and what am I going to do? Yeah. One or two more, maybe from more towards the back. Yes? Ooh, yes. This is all wholly negative. No sense of where we might go if we were, if this prayer were answered even. Yeah. Yes. Not important not to miss that. Deliver us from, every Christian knows the end of that sentence, deliver us from evil. But here, evil, culture, evil, pretty much all the same thing. Just get me out. Now, the remarkable thing is that this prayer actually directly contradicts a prayer we overhear Jesus praying in John 17, where Jesus explicitly says in front of his disciples and through John, the inspired recorder of the prayer, for all of us in our hearing, he says, Father, I am not asking you to take them out of the world. I am asking you to protect them in the world, but I'm not asking you to take them out. And it's as if this message says, you know, thank you, Jesus, for praying that, but actually we've tried it for 2,000 years, and please just take us out. Like, beam me up. Get me out of here. One other question I have about this commercial message is, what if this prayer were answered? Where would God deliver us to? Where would we be? If we were delivered from culture, where would we be? Because human beings only live and thrive in the context of culture. So culture is not just bad movies I don't want my kids to watch. It's not Game of Thrones I don't want our chief film critic at CT to watch, but she does anyway. It's not just bad stuff. Culture is buildings. Do we want to be delivered from buildings? Well, every spring, students ask for this. They say, can we have class outside? Have you ever actually tried to have class outside? Disaster. If we took away this building, as beautiful as it is on this campus, as temperate as it is, we could not do what we're doing. We couldn't have sung the way we sang. There's something that buildings give us that amplify and concentrate human experience. Language. Culture is language. Do we want to be delivered from language? Culture is clothing. Many years ago now, I got to go to Greece and saw these nude beaches in Greece and realized what a gift clothing is to 98%... Oh my goodness. The sight on the beaches of Crete facing the Libyan Sea of British tourists turning to the color of lobsters in the Mediterranean sun. It is permanently seared in my memory. And I realized, wow, clothing is, you think it's going to be vaguely titillating or exciting, and you get there, you're like, oh, please put something on. For the love of God, a neighbor, just clothe yourselves. Deliver us from clothing. It's a crazy prayer. Now, I will not go on to say, that's a rhetorical device that says I'm actually going to say it. I will not go on to say that this book is, of course, published by a publisher, and a book is culture, and a publisher is culture. It's an advertisement that is culture. It happens to be published by a publishing house I have a lot of friends at, Zondervan, which is owned by News Corp, the Murdoch family's multimedia conglomerate, which last time I checked is part of culture. So what is going on in this prayer, in this misguided prayer? But isn't this something we feel? I mean, we may not have the same list of things we want to be delivered from as the implied audience of this book, but when you really confront the reality of our broken human societies, when you look at trends such as those that have already been mentioned here, and you wonder, where is this world going? Is there not a temptation to say, either take me out or commission me for a cleanup operation that is actually deeply Manichaean in its assumptions? That is, it assumes that the toxins are out there, the cleanliness is in here, and our job is to stay protected while we try to bring a little, you know, sort of clean up the mess. And I wondered, why is this our picture and not something maybe more like this? So here's a kid, a little hard to see in the projection, but it's this kid who's been playing in the dirt. His hands are completely dirty. He's so thrilled about this that he's holding them out for the photographer, his mom or dad, I suppose, to see. He's totally covered in dirt because he's been digging in the dirt, which is one of the things kids do. And he has a sense of pride, glee, excitement, and an eagerness to find a nearby white wall and just plant those hands. And why are his parents, assuming that his parents are on the other end of this display of dirt, why are they not worried about him? I mean, it's dirty. There's toxins in that dirt. There's bacteria in that stuff. He has an immune system. He's got skin that protects him from it. He's actually equipped to go out, dig in the dirt, and his body is miraculously, I think it's not too much to say, equipped to distinguish. If any of those toxins get in, his body can sort out what's healthy, what's benign, what's actually malign. And one of the most fascinating things about this moment in our particular North American technological history is that we are now so little exposed to dirt, our children and grandchildren are so little exposed to dirt, that there is some reason to think that this is causing their immune systems to not be able to distinguish healthy from unhealthy, which is why we have a rise in autoimmune diseases of various kinds, asthma and other kinds of autoimmune diseases. So that actually the desire to protect your children from digging in the dirt and encountering the whole mix of stuff that's there may actually be preventing them from acquiring the healthy ability to discern at a biological level, bacteriological level, what's healthy and what's not. And anyway, this is so much more fun than getting on the gloves and heading out in a cleanup operation. And this is what human beings were meant to do. So I want to give us a picture, two pictures really, one sociological, one biblical theological, of what it is to be in the midst of culture. And today is pretty much all good news. Tomorrow, I have some bad news. But today, all good news. And it starts, in fact, by thinking about this word culture. And just very briefly, some of you read my book, you'll know some of this. But I thought it would be helpful just to talk about what, essentially, what the people who study culture, anthropologists and sociologists, what do they mean when they use that word? Well, I ran into a really good summary of it from a fellow journalist named Ken Myers, who produces this extraordinary podcast and audio resource called the Mars Hill Audio Journal. And Ken had this great definition of culture that I have now completely stolen and use everywhere, always crediting him. And it's so simple, I can remember it, which is awesome. He says, culture is what human beings make of the world. Culture is what human beings make of the world. And then he adds a wonderful three more words, in both senses. Culture is what human beings make of the world in both senses. That is, culture is what human beings make of the world in the very simple sense that it is the stuff human beings make. It's the actual things. The activity of human beings in the world creates what we call cultural artifacts. So our clothes would be an example of this. Some human being, many human beings, harvested some kind of fiber. I don't know. This grew on a polyamide tree, I believe. Spun it, dyed it, shaped it, stitched it. And wherever we see evidence of human beings, through the whole archaeological record, we see them making stuff, buildings, making sound, right? Making actual articulations of sound, like I'm doing right now, and as you did a moment ago, talking with your neighbor. It's physical. It's material. But culture is also what human beings make of the world. And the other sense of that phrase, make something of. That is to say, it's about making meaning. What did you make of what Andy said, you might say? You aren't really asking for a thing. You're asking for an explanation, an interpretation. And so culture is both of these things. The things we make and the human quest for meaning. Because everywhere we look, we find with human beings, not just that they make stuff, but they seem to have this incorrigible need to make sense of the world as well. Over my head, I hear music in the air. There must be a God somewhere. That's the voice of a human being who, with incomplete data and many reasons to disbelieve it, says, I sense there's something harmonious about this cosmos I find myself in. I sense there's something of ultimate significance in this cosmos, God being one way to name that ultimate significance. And the interesting thing is, the way we make sense, the way we make meaning, is to make stuff. Write songs, build buildings, create podiums. Look around the room, it's full of culture. And we do it to make sense of the world. And then once we've made sense, we make more stuff, and that stuff starts to make sense of the world for us, and it's this cycle. I don't have time to go into all that, but let me give you a couple pictures. Every presentation is improved with a picture of a baby, so this is, here's the baby. It's the number one Google image result for the word baby, so it's not a baby I've ever met or anything. It's just a cute baby, but it serves to remind us that all of us were once at this stage of life. Every single person in this room once was as wide-eyed and bald as this fellow. And one of the most extraordinary things that babies do is that they make something of the world. And they do it from day one. And the thing I'm thinking about particularly is sound. Babies make sound. Because when you are an infant, and I suppose, I don't know, how old is this guy? Maybe 4 months, 5 months. At this stage, you can't make a lot of things. You don't have a lot of volitional control over your environment or even over your own body. You haven't even learned to walk. Maybe your hands and feet haven't even found out they can, like, hang out together, you know. But there's one thing that you have volitional control over pretty much from day one, and that's your vocal tract. Lungs, larynx, tongue, teeth, resonating cavities in your head. And so the baby, ooh, I think a baby's doing it right now. Awesome. I love it. So when something's wrong in the baby's world, they make one kind of sound, which is they cry. So there are basically only three things that can be wrong in a baby's world. It can be tired, it can be hungry, or it can be in need of a change, right? And when any one of those three things is going on, you start to get increasingly plaintive sounds. Sounds like we're at like stage one, DEFCON stage one back there. And the parent's job is to figure out, okay, which of the three is it this time? Which is the great conundrum of the first few months of parenting. And eventually you figure it out. And when the baby is well rested, has had a meal, and has a nice clean nappy on, a diaper on, they don't cry. Instead, DEFCON 2, Oh, and by the way, we human beings, we are designed to respond to that. Like, that overwhelms anything I'm doing up here. You're like, baby crying, baby. That's how relational we are. We just have to, I need to pray for that papa back there. But when the baby is happy or is taken out of the room so the speaker can continue his presentation, babies don't cry. They just experiment. So they'll put their lips together and they'll activate the larynx as the air goes by, and they'll make the sound ba, 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 ba. And then they'll try holding off on activating the larynx until the air has already gone by. It's an unvoiced bilabial consonant. And the baby will say pa, 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 pa. So the baby tries all these combinations. This is what babies do. We're built to do this. You all did this. We all did it. So the baby can try a dental consonant where the tongue's right behind the teeth and leave it unvoiced, ta, 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 ta. And one day the baby decides, okay, let's try activating the larynx, tongue behind the teeth, so we get a voiced dental consonant. Da, 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 da. At this moment, an extraordinary thing happens in the baby's world. Lying in the crib, da, 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 da. This very important figure in the baby's life appears over the crib, picks the baby up, and says, she's saying, or he's saying, da-da, daddy. which the baby was not doing. This is just voice dental consonant day. It's like, well, that's an interesting sound. And the baby has this glimmer of awareness that says, I think I just made sense. I think I actually just did one of the most characteristic human things. I think I just named. I made a name of this really important and mysterious and large and jubilant person. And at that moment, the baby enters the world of culture as a creator of culture and realizes, I didn't just make sound, I made sense. I made sound that made sense. I made sense by making a sound. And now the baby is en route to the most extraordinary thing that human beings do, which is the acquisition of language. Because by age 5, this baby will have total command of the syntax of the human language and will have access to thousands and thousands of vocabulary words in that language. It's the most impressive thing any human being does. You have already done the most impressive thing you will ever do just by acquiring language. And you did it out of sheer grace and fun because you were wired to do it. You found delight in doing it, and those around you found delight as you did it. They did not have to teach you. They didn't have to coerce you. They just had to be around you, speak the language, reinforce you when you said something cuter or cooler, you know, or unexpected. And you just grew into that cultural achievement as an image bearer of the one who is the Word, made flesh, meaning, made material. Oh, I'm getting way ahead of myself. We look back not just at the beginning of every human life, but at the beginning of human history, and we find evidence of this. This is a little, I apologize if the images are a little washed out, but this is a cave painting from, I believe this one's from Mirabeau, one of the caves of Spain. It's a bison painted on a cave ceiling, not on a cave wall. I always imagined that cave paintings were these kind of scribbles or doodles that, you know, Grog and his family did while they were waiting out the thunderstorm. They're like, well, I might as well draw on the wall here. This is no scribble. This bison, rendered in several different pigments, is painted on the ceiling of a cave that is approximately 12 to 15 feet off the floor of the cave. Maybe not quite as high as this, but almost. And it is 6 feet across, a full arm span across. Now, once you know that, what was necessary? A ladder? What is necessary to paint a 6-foot-wide bison on the ceiling of a cave? Ladder, light, memory, the ability to recall that image and process that image in a way that allows us to render. A plan, coordination, paint, pigments, imagination, cooperation, a sense of perspective. Picasso got to visit these caves. When he came out, he said, we've learned nothing. They had already figured out how to render 3 dimensions in 2, which is done beautifully in the modeling of this figure, as faded as it is. This is earlier than almost any, it's as early as fire. It's as early as evidence of fire. As early as human beings are making tools, they're making art. And this is because human beings are in the world to make sense of the world. We are not satisfied with things that are just useful. We're not just satisfied with killing and eating the bison, though no doubt if you could catch one, that would be a great thing to do in the time that this was painted. But there is also a need simply to contemplate and respond and say, what in the world does this mean? Because this animal is impressive. And it testifies to something bigger. There's no way that this was painted without some religious impulse animating the community that produced it. We find language, we find art, and then, more recently, we have other ways of making something of the world, and I want to give you just one last picture of that. It's a picture of my wife. I am related to this person. This is my wife, Catherine. Catherine's an experimental physicist. So I married up in every possible way, and we have religion and science at the dinner table every night. And I have this picture of Catherine. It's not the greatest picture. It's kind of low res and fuzzy, but I want it because she's in her lab in this picture. And Catherine does tabletop optics experiments. So behind her is an optical apparatus that bounces a laser around a table, progressively refracting it and purifying the signal until it eventually impinges on a very small piece of semiconducting material. And when it does, amazing things happen that I really can't explain, and I don't really know what they are, so I'm not going to go on, but apparently people think this is really cool because she got tenure. So what's Catherine doing in her vocation as a physicist? She is making something in the world, literally making an apparatus that deals with the physical reality of the world. And yet, at the same time, there's something else my wife does that I don't understand, which is math. And math is the purest human activity of making sense. It's the most theoretical thing that human beings do with their brains, I think. And the amazing thing, so here are, I don't know what that those equations are, or what those formalisms are, but
Faraday's law.
Yeah, I knew it was electromagnetic something. So here's the property of electromagnetic fields, and you can, on a blackboard, think about what would be the most elegant way to represent this kind of system, and then you can go into the lab and do physical experiments, and the sense-making and the stuff-making perfectly cohere. And in fact, the more beautiful and elegant and precise and pristine the sense-making, the more accurately it predicts what happens in the lab when the experiment is done to a high level of precision. There was a scientist who wrote a very influential paper a number of decades ago now called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Physical Sciences. That we human beings are constituted so we can just come up with math in our heads, some of us. Not ones who went to seminary like me, but others like my wife who, can come up with these mathematical systems. And then when we go out and investigate reality, we find it corresponds beautifully all the way down to these mathematical systems, even to the point that you can invent a mathematical system that has no apparent physical implication, like Hilbert spaces, which are fields of complex numbers that are just, Hilbert dreamed them up in the early 20th century and said, let's just play with this mathematical idea. It's a very complex kind of set theory thing. Well, when people start doing experiments in quantum physics, they discover they need the math that Paul Hilbert, had come up with completely on his own, and that math, including the imaginary number component of complex numbers, the square root of -1, which doesn't even mean anything to us, that is necessary to explain quantum mechanical systems. It's as if the world was waiting for us to come along and use the gifts of making sense and making stuff and discover it is far more beautiful, far more elegant, all the way down than we ever imagined. Now, if this is what culture is, why would you ever even want to pray, deliver us from culture? If culture is the human activity of cultivating the world in such a way that its sense comes to light, that its abundance becomes revealed, why would you ever say, I'm not interested in that? And this leads to the question of what you believe about creation. So that first part was sociological. Now, a few words, biblical, theological. I have to do this very fast because I'm using oodles of time. It doesn't feel that way to you, but it does feel that way to you. It doesn't feel that way to me. I'm just barely getting started, and you're like, wow, this is going on and on. My goodness. So, a couple things about creation. You know, and in the presence of an Old Testament scholar, I am hardly going to try to pronounce authoritatively on this, so I'm going to go very quickly over it and hopefully not make any big mistakes that I'll be called out on later. You know that the first 3 days of creation, as told in this amazing liturgical poem in Genesis 1, are days of ordering, days of structuring the world. First, light and dark, then the realm of the heavens and the realm of the terrestrial realm, then sea and land. Simple divisions that create order within a world that initially is formless and void, tohu bohu. And then days 4, 5, and 6 are about filling that order with what I'm going to call abundance. There's a little bit of semantic overlap between Walter's presentations and mine. By abundance, I may have a slightly different meaning than he was using, so I apologize if there's any confusion there. But when I think of abundance, what I'm thinking of is this interesting word that's used twice in Genesis 1, which is the word teeming. It says that God created, among other things, the birds that teem in the sky and the fish that teem in the sea. Now, what I think of teeming as is extraordinary, uncontrollable, unpredictable abundance. It's a kind of profusion of being that cannot be limited in some narrowly ordered way, even though it relies on order to exist. So a school of fish, a school of hundreds or thousands of fish, no one can predict where that teeming school of fish is going to go. It just goes where it wills, and it turns on a dime with these signals that we can't possibly get inside and imagine. And God wants his world filled, his ordered world, each realm of his ordered world, filled with that kind of abundance. So the realm of dark and light is now filled with sun, moon, and stars. The heavens are filled with birds. The sea is filled with teeming, swimming creatures, and the land teems with animals. God wants a world of order and abundance. And this leads to one of my favorite things, which is a 2x2 chart. So I have to do this really fast. If you have neither order nor abundance, you have formlessness and void. That is no structure and no variety, no unpredictable filling, nothing at all. If you have abundance without order, that's chaos. If you have order without abundance, that's a modern achievement called the machine. A machine is a specific kind of cultural product that so tightly orders its environment that its output is always linear, or at least always predictable. I won't say linear, but always rule-governed, tightly rule-bound. A machine always generates the same result, the ideal machine. It's pure order, no unpredictable variety. Neither chaos nor machines are the Creator's intention for the world. The Creator intends a cosmos, to use the Greek word, and I just use that to intend a world that has both order and abundance, both structure and variety, both rule-governed life, which the whole world is governed by beautiful, simple mathematical rules, and yet those rules are constituted in such a way that when creatures live within them, you get all this unpredictable, teeming variety. Order and abundance are not opposed to each other. They both coordinate to fulfill the Creator's plan for creation. Very simple example of this, maybe an odd thing to bring up, but is sexual reproduction, which is based on order, male, female, and deeper down we now know, DNA, which is a highly ordered, essentially binary code encoded in two languages, and in one sense, totally rule-governed, and built on a binary structure, male, female. They come together, not just in human beings, but all creatures that reproduce sexually, and through that combination of order, the DNA that's exchanged and combined, you get an unpredictable result. As any of us who have been children or are children know, we are not just the machine-like output of two parents whose gametes combine in a rule-governed way to produce like an average. You're not an average of your parents. You are a complete new being with new possibilities, undreamed of by your parents, sometimes unwished for by your parents. And you are abundance that came out of an entirely, in one sense, entirely rule-governed, highly binary, highly structured human reality, which is the creation of human beings, male and female. It's order that produces abundance. Same thing with language. Totally rule-governed. If I stop speaking in English syntax, we can't communicate at all. And yet within the syntax of English, which is a highly specified ordered system, I am able to take the raw materials of the English language and our shared inheritance and our fluency in it and create new things that I may have never said myself. And I learned in college when I took linguistics that actually linguists believe so fruitful is human language that every fully linguistically competent human being, that is everyone who's at the age of 7 and is sort of neurotypical, has many times in their life spoken a sentence that never has been spoken in the history of the language before. Every one of you, unless you are a very dull person, has taken the rule-governed, limited set of vocabulary, didn't make up new words, didn't make up new rules, and yet you spoke a sentence in the whole history of the language that no one has spoken. Wow. Cosmos. What's the next slide? Oh, art in the 20th century got this confused. So it went in two directions, modern art. In one direction, it went in the direction of total order, mathematical order, very nearly, a very highly, tightly specified grid, Mondrian. And in the other direction, it went in Jackson Pollock's direction, which was almost sheer chaos. Now Mondrian has all kinds of abundance actually in it. That's why they're great artists. But it's overdetermined on the order side. Pollock has actually some surprising dimensions of order. First of all, it's on a rectangular canvas. It's within a space. So it's all already rule-governed in that way. But underdetermined in structure, we might say. And the 20th century was this contest between these two visions of what it is to be human. Are we machines, or are we just at will to completely team without any respect of the rule-governed, ordered, structured? Is there any good to order and structure? It's the same contest in music between Boulez, who wrote whole pieces of music that were strictly generated by mathematical formalisms and went through tone rows in just completely mechanical ways, and on the other hand, John Cage, who refused to make notes at all and said, let's experiment with just unordered sound. Maybe that's what music is. But of course it's both, right? And so artists like the contemporary artist Makoto Fujimura can paint paintings like this, where he uses gold leaf, squares of gold leaf, echoing Mondrian, a kind of structure, a rectilinear structure, but he's also, in the manner of Pollock, an abstract expressionist, splashed paint on the canvas, allowed it to go in places that he's not fully in control of. And then his grid is broken down in various ways. This piece is called Golden Summer, for the record. And in this piece, Mako is trying to reunite order and abundance, create something that both has structure and has unpredictable variety. Actually, both the crimson of blood and death, but also the blue, deep cerulean blue of water, sky, cleansing. And he's reaching for a new artistic vocabulary that reunites these and creates a cosmos kind of art. All right, wow. I did not expect it would take me this long to get to this point, and I always think preachers should have in front of them a quote from John 14, I have much more to say to you, but you cannot bear it now. All right, let me do one more thing, and then I'll stop, and I'll pick up tomorrow. I think it's my next thing. Yes, let me show you how this works with music and sound, and then I'll be done. Is that okay, Terry? Do I have permission to take 45 minutes? Yeah, great. Okay. So here's how the world is ordered. When you take any resonating substance, say a string of metal, and you stretch it, so it's suspended on both ends, so there's no tension in the string, and you strike it, you get a particular tone. And in this case, I'm playing a low C. And as I do that, the hammer is striking the string. But the interesting thing about strings, and this is sheer physics, which in its turn is sheer mathematics, the interesting thing about strings is that they don't actually resonate with just one note. And those of you who are guitarists or played a stringed instrument know this. You actually generate a whole set of notes in one single string, which are called the overtone series. So it vibrates at the lowest frequency that it's capable of. That's the low C that you're primarily hearing. But then, in that same string starts to vibrate the octave above, twice as fast frequency. And sometimes I can demonstrate this. I don't know if this piano will do it, but if I strike this low note, but I hold down this next C up so that it can ring if it wants to, I just hold it open so the damper's not touching, so I'm holding it down. If I strike this low C, the upper C, the next C, may start to resonate. We'll see. Let's try it. So that upper C starts to ring because its note is in that lower note. The next overtone that resonates is the fifth above the octave, which is a G. It's not another C. It's a different note. And that also starts to ring. We can try it. I don't know if you'll hear it, but I'm going to hold down that G and do the same thing. I play that low C, and the G will start to ring. Let's see if we hear it. By the power of suggestion, you do hear it. It's quite amazing. And this is what we call the overtone series. It keeps going, and a couple overtones later, you get the E of the C major chord, which is another overtone. And the reason that major chords sound so harmonious to us, so let me play a C major chord. The reason that sounds, isn't that beautiful? It's so nice. It's a very Christian chord, I think. Very harmonious, very appropriate. The reason it sounds that way is all those overtones line up so nicely, right? So you can take that, so that's where the major chord comes from. You can play that out. Just play those notes in sequence a couple times. So now you've created a very, very simple structure if you're Johann Sebastian Bach. And then you can say, well, what if we go to a related chord that just introduces the next degree of tension between overtones, and we might go here. And now the overtones don't all line up in the way they did in that major chord. And then we could, it seems to lead almost inexorably to something like this. And because of the physical properties of those notes, they lead us back to this. So let me just play that 4-bar sequence again. And what Bach has done in these 4 opening bars is he's taken a very simple structure, started with the major chord, and he's gone essentially to the next 2 chords, 4 and 5, 1-4-5-1. It's actually 2-7 and 5-7 for the musicians in the room, but it's basically 1-4-5-1. C, F, kind of modified, G. And he's come back to that home chord. And if you know these 3 chords, you can be a worship leader. That's not true. You'll actually need one more. You need the relative minor, A minor in this key, and that's where he goes next. But then Bach says, I think there might be some other chords out there. Let's try keeping the exact same structure, but just moving further away from that home chord and exploring what else we can do with these 12 tones. So there will be moments of consonants like this, but then moments of dissonance. Here's a diminished chord for the first time, and it seems to lead to something like this. Another moment of tension, diminished chord, resolution. And what Bach is really doing in the first prelude, which is the simplest thing he wrote, and so it's the only thing that I can play and talk at the same time, is that he's saying, look at everything you can do with the simplest of structures. You can have beautiful moments. You can also have moments of great tension. You can have moments of great dissonance. Here's the most dissonant chord in the whole piece. That's highly dissonant. We're actually at the very center of the piece, and we're at the most dissonant moment. And if I just play that chord splat, all those overtones fight. So let me do it. Woo. Extremely unchristian moment in this. But in the context of the piece, even the dissonance is essential to the beauty of the piece. The dissonance actually is part of the story. It's part of the abundance, part of the variety. And now what Bach is doing is he's saying, okay, I've taken you to the most dissonant moment. Here's one more moment of dissonance. But it leads to this resolution, and now he's preparing you to go back to that home chord. But not before one last moment of surprise. It comes right here. Hear that little suspense? And then we get the 4. And the 5. And we're home. One last thought. There's a mystery in Genesis 1. The liturgical poem is interrupted. Day 6 comes, the realm of order, sea and land gets filled. And at every point in the poem up till now, it said, and God saw that it was good, it was evening, it was morning, and you think, okay, day 6 is done. And there's an interruption in the sequence, and suddenly God speaks in a way God has not yet spoken and says, let us make. And in the image of God, creates these image bearers, male and female, he created them. And then at the end of that, day 6 is done, and now it doesn't just say God saw it was good, it says he saw it was tov tov, good, good, very good. Why? Because now in the world are creatures who themselves are going to order, who themselves are going to bring structure like Bach does with sound. And so now the world will not just be full of sound, it'll be full of music. Now in the world there are creatures who have a yearning for abundance. They're going to search out the unpredictable variety of the world. They themselves will be unpredictably various. And they will cultivate the world in such a way that all the goodness of the world is brought to fullness and becomes very good. That's culture. That's what we're here for, the flourishing of the world. And tomorrow I will talk about why that's not the world we have. And it has to do with what happened to the image. But for now, let's offer a moment of prayer and then I think I'll be done. For the joy of ear and eye, for the heart and mind's delight, for the mystic harmony linking sense to sound and sight. Lord of all, to thee we raise this our hymn of grateful praise. In Jesus' name.